The date. What date are we today?
The
6th of December. Right. Yep. Today it is a kind of wet day. It always seems to be a bit wet, but we're in a nice warm van today. 6th of December, and I'm with John Craig in Hathersedge, which is a small village in Derbyshire, which most people, I think, will be familiar with. We're doing an early morning podcast today, so we'll say morning.
Good morning. Right, I'm John, and I have sort of two lines of work that I deal with. One is a tax and accountancy practice, but there are plenty of accountants out there and plenty of tax experts. And the other is business consultancy. And maybe perhaps a bit of background as to how I got to where I am. Mm-hmm. Could be helpful. I was born in London a long time ago. Was very privileged to have gone to probably the best academic school in Britain. When I say best academic, 52% go to Oxbridge, which is the highest of any school in the world.
You're going to have to name it after that.
Westminster.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. I wasn't going to name it, but
Westminster. Well, we've got to get all the facts and figures, yeah.
And I did very well up to O-level. I got 10 O-levels and then did less well at A-level because my parents were in a wholly dysfunctional marriage and things were very, very difficult. But I got university entrance, but at the age of 17, my parents split up. Oh, totally. Right. It was just a complete, it was a complete bloodbath, but never divorced. And my father being probably one of the top two child psychiatrists in the UK, and because there was no formal separation, there was no way I could go to uni. So at 17, I had to make choices, as did my sister. And my sister carried on a bit and got an open scholarship to Bedford in London, but was never able to take it up because she couldn't get a grant, as indeed neither could I.
Right.
So we then got into the real world of going into to actually work for our bread.
Yes.
To actually pay the rent and all the rest of it.
Right.
And I started in banking. Stayed a week, at the end of which I found it was the worst possible thing. I started as a management trainee, and it was not for me. I thought it would be. And my sister also started in banking, but she stayed. Latterly, she decided to, after she had a family, she decided to go back to uni. Got a doctorate at Sheffield and became the principal reader in psychology at Sheffield and professor of psychology at Swansea, and now is a visiting professor at Singapore. But that was in her 40s, so she did very well from 40 onwards.
Right.
I, upon the other hand, went from banking into industry, into an electrical, industrial electrical company, which actually did most of the work for the National Coal Board, British Steel, etc., in terms of what you call high voltage electrical stuff. We're talking in terms of cables, not the size of your domestic cables, but things as big as your thigh.
Yeah.
So true. Things of this nature, up to about certainly 33 kV.
Right.
So we didn't go up to 33, but we came to the level below 33 kV. And that company, I started as a buyer, trainee buyer. Survived at the tender age of 19 and then became their buyer. And it was taken over by one of the largest industrial, mixed industrial PLCs in the UK. It was about the 100th largest PLC in the UK.
Right.
So that opened up a whole load of other opportunities. And by the time I was in my mid to late 20s, I was probably one of the two most senior purchasing managers within the whole of the PLC.
Right.
So I had a very strong commercial background.
Was this up north?
I was based in Sheffield, I was based in Leeds, I was based in Scunthorpe.
So I was
in sort of Lincolnshire, South Yorkshire,
yeah.
That kind of area.
Okay, right.
What then happened was that I realised that there was never going to be a group purchasing director. I was one of the two group purchasing managers.
Yeah.
With a responsibility of about 100 million a year, so it was quite substantial. But there was never going to be anyone at a level above that.
Right.
So I needed some advice. I went to the guy who'd actually hired me, who'd actually become a Maybole director of the whole of Staveley, Staveley Industries.
Okay.
And he advised me of going in one of two directions, either to become an accountant or join what he called the accounting mafia. He was an engineer. He hated accountants.
Yeah.
Or become a company secretary. One of the two. He said, if you want to spend your life playing with figures and doing nothing else, then become an accountant. If, upon the other hand, you want to be at board level or close to board level for most of your life, at the strategic level of a business, become a chartered company secretary, which is exactly what I did.
Right.
Sounds easy. It took
a long time.
It took 5 years to become chartered.
Right. Right.
Working, I mean, it's an honours degree equivalent, and it's a charter qualification. It's equivalent to a chartered accountant, but you can imagine a chartered accountant as your left hand, a solicitor as your right hand, and then bang between the two is a chartered company secretary that knows a hell of a lot more law than chartered accountants, but less accountancy,
right,
and a lot more accountancy than solicitors, but less law.
Right.
So it's quite an interesting, it's quite an interesting role within a business. And in fact, in company law, the only person that has to be qualified that's employed by a company is the company secretary.
Right.
Your finance director doesn't have to be qualified. Your chief executive doesn't have to be qualified.
No.
But your company secretary has to be qualified.
Okay.
So I became that, and as soon as I qualified, I looked around the group, and there was an opportunity for a finance manager, and I applied for it, and I got it.
Right.
And within 2 years, I was finance director of that company. Then I became finance director of three in total, other Staveley subsidiaries, significant companies, employing probably 300 or 400 people each, over the next 13 years.
Right. No. So I'm doing some calculations here in my head.
Yeah.
So you followed in your sister's footsteps and starting late in a career.
Well, I started early in my career, I started studying for the Charter Secretary sort of mid-20s.
Right.
And before I was 30, I got it.
Right.
And in fact, I became president of the Institute for South Yorkshire and Nottinghamshire in my mid-30s, just before I was 40. I was probably one of the youngest ever presidents in Sheffield. So I'm deeply proud of that.
And that was all through Staveley Industries?
That was,
So
I was trained within Staveley, which was helpful. Staveley Industries, which doesn't exist now. It's been bought by Guinness Peat.
Right,
But it was about the 100th largest PLC in the UK.
Oh, was it? Right,
and hugely diversified, which is huge. Mm. It was purely industrial.
Yes.
So with that kind of background, I was strong commercial, quite strong financial, quite strong legal. Staveley went through a very bad patch. They became moribund, and they got in a new chief executive who was the guy who'd been head of Lucas Aerospace. And his first question to the board was, what is your corporate strategy? Well, they sort of didn't have one. So he took what he called his 30 top executives down to a place called Selsdon Park.
Yeah.
In Croydon, and fortunately I was one of those, and for a week's training in corporate strategy, and that was ostensibly what it was all about.
Right. Okay.
What it wasn't about was it was actually a selection process to select three people to actually take us for the next year working with a company called Arthur D. Little, which is as big as McKinsey's internationally, actually look at where Staveley was going.
Yeah.
And I was one of those three people. I don't think because I was by any means the best accountant or best company secretary, but I was two for the price of one. I was deeply, deeply, deeply commercial, having been head of purchasing and also had the financial side as well. So I was one of those three, and I worked for a year on that. And at the end of it, I decided that Staveley was moribund, and I left them. But part of the process was I was working with a management consultant who had a degree in chemistry and a diploma in management studies.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing wrong with that, except he was trying to shoehorn his perceptions of all the problems within Staveley into his own experience only. And that deeply worried me, because that you can't do that. You've got to really have lots of pairs of eyes looking at the problem from different perspectives to actually see what the real problem is. Probably 6 months after that process, and I did that for a year, I left Staveley to start my own business, which was a joint practice of chartered company secretaries and chartered management accountants who worked very well together. That was based in Rotherham. That worked very well until my deputy was poached by a company called Marston's, Evershedden, Vineyards, Brewers. They make Marston's beers.
Oh, well, okay.
Marston's beers in Burton, who came along with a massive salary and a big Beamer. And of course, my colleague came and said, "Can you match this?" And I said, "No."
Yeah.
So he went. And then shortly after that, his deputy had a heart attack. So I'd gone from a one-person practice to a five-partner practice, back to about two to three.
Right, yeah.
And I still have that practice, but we now specialise in tax and accountancy. The process, obviously, of working with Arthur D. Little had persuaded me that if you're going to look at corporate problems, you've got to be looking at it from different perspectives. Mm-hmm. Now, sort of following through on that line, back in 2002, I decided I was going to take a master's in business, so I took an MBA.
Yeah.
Again, you don't just do that. It took me 4 years to do that.
Yeah, okay.
It took me till 2006. And then, having done that, I then started the process of forming, over the next several years, my ideas about where I wanted to take a business. I still have the tax and accountancy practice, which is local here. And I cover the Hope Valley, and I have private clients in London and Scotland, etc. But I'm available here for anybody that wants it. And what came through after that, after a lot of sort of thinking about it, I decided that the kind of benchmarks I would want for my colleagues were going to be, A, they had to have the same ideas and the same standards.
Yeah.
They would either have to be chartered or MBA'd or both. They would all have to be over 40 or even over 50 and highly experienced and have done the job.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I still resent to a large extent is you find an awful lot of accountancy practices actually claim to be accountants, tax advisors and business advisors. Now, that defies any kind of logic to me. Accountants, yes, agree with that. They know financial accounts, that's their skill set.
Yeah. Okay.
They do auditing, that's their skill set. Mm. They do tax, that's their skill set. They know nothing virtually about supply chain management.
Right.
They know nothing, in most cases, about human resources management. They know nothing about marketing. They know nothing about corporate strategy. So they know about financial strategy. So I think to have the gall to call themselves business advisors, and you see that so often on their nameplates,
yes,
I think is a huge misrepresentation.
Right.
So I decided that I would have a mixed practice. That's what I'm coming to. And the mixed practice, if I take my colleagues, Mistral was formed about 4 years ago. We're all equal. It's a totally flat structure. There's no hierarchy except I'm the chairman of it.
Right.
And it's an elected chairman every year. We're all equal shareholders. We have an equal voice amongst the six directors. We're all, again, we tick the boxes of being over 50. We're all either chartered or MBA'd. And if you take between us the qualifications we have, which are not really the important thing, but to a lot of people, they seem to be important.
Right.
We have two charter company secretaries, we have a chartered accountant, we have a charter management accountant as associates. Those accountants are associates.
Right.
We have one chartered management accountant who is a director. We have a chartered marketeer, we have CIPD, which is Chartered Institute of Personnel Development.
Mm-hmm.
We have a chartered banker, and we have two fellows of the Chartered Management Institute. And we have three MBAs.
Right.
So half of us have got MBAs as well.
Okay. Right.
And what we do is we go into businesses which are struggling. We go in, first of all, any one of us can go into a company to actually assess it, and we will spend up to 2 days looking at it at our cost, no one else. We call that our due diligence process.
Yeah. Okay.
And in doing that, we will then, that person or the two consultants that come back after those 2-3 days, will actually come back and present to our board their case for actually taking this on as a client Mistral Associates. And if they can't convince the board, it doesn't happen. And it has to be unanimous. There can't be any abstentions. There has to be total unanimity from the board to actually accept any client. Because we put our money where our mouth is. If we can't add value, we will give them. We will repay our fee if necessary to the client. So the parameter has to be that we can add value, which means that the client has to also be competent enough and open enough to work with us. We're not shadow directors. We understand the law. We're well aware of the law of the shadow director risks, but we can walk that line very carefully. So we can get much more involved than their accountants or their solicitors. We can actually get involved in the day-to-day strategic management and strategic direction of the business. You're not talking quick fixes. You're talking probably working with them for 6 months.
Okay.
Possibly 1 or 2 days a week,
yep.
But it's actually taking the business forward. So we'll look at businesses which are struggling, businesses which are actually in deep decline, possibly almost on the verge of bankruptcy, if we feel we can save them. And that's part of the mindset of the management as well as our help. And also businesses which are perfectly sound financially, but don't know where the hell to go next.
Right. This is
It's unique.
I can say it's unique. It's interesting. You've got it's not a one man view.
No, it's a six person or seven person.
So you bring it in, right.
Or coming from different directions.
It does sort of the first thing that comes to mind. Just for the sake of is that the uninitiated, a company that requires this sort of help sounds scaled, large scale.
We will happily work within a 2-hour drive of Sheffield.
Yep.
We're based actually in Eme. We were based in Sheffield, but we have an office now in Eme. So a 2-hour radius of Sheffield by car. If you're to talk in terms of Mistral, I mean, I can do it myself through my accountancy practice as a single person, but then you're only getting one view of it. I'm much broader. I'm the GP, if you like, of the practice.
Yeah,
okay. Being, say, strongly commercial, MBA and accountancy.
Yeah.
And I'm a qualified accountant as well.
Yeah, okay.
But if you want Mistral itself, you need to be turning over between 2 and 25 million.
Right.
That kind of ballpark. You're talking in terms of businesses which are probably going to be employing at least 20, if not 200, 300, 400, 500 people.
Right.
But again, it depends upon what they need and how much time they need. The other thing we will not do, there are consultants out there which will rip people off on a daily rate. We don't, none of us, because we're all established and because we've all paid our mortgages off, being blunt about it,
we
don't need the money. All right, we need paying, but we don't need huge amounts of money. So we come in at a sensible consultancy rate, which is very, 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 very competitive, because we do it because we want to add something back. That's where we're coming from, as much as anything.
So you're looking to demonstrate. Well, we in this bizarre world we live in at the moment, and we really do need successes, and we can't have large companies failing, or which are providing revenue and everything else. Now, just this morning there was there's a company that you just reminded me of something that's gone out of my head now. I like to do this. You're listening to your radio when you're sat in the car or something, and something sort of pricks your attention. But it's probably never come across it before. But there's a company this morning, and I'll think about it in a minute. It's a household name type thing.
Yep.
Struggling like hell. Appears to be leaking money everywhere. People really don't support them any longer. It feels like the 20th century. That sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So you've got. And forgive me on this basis, because we're all sort of a similar age. But it's what is it that six old? I'm assuming they're all male, actually.
No, we're not.
Ah,
no, 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 George Ender. Oh, no, no,
right,
no, no.
So you have that.
Okay, well, Julia would be very upset at that. Okay, yes. Right, okay. We did have two ladies. We now only have one, sadly. But okay.
There's one assumption I shouldn't have made.
Yes.
But let's say, so six older...
Mature.
Experience.
Put the nice...
Are they bringing the 21st century? Because the interesting thing about what I do, which we could talk about another time, you probably still don't know, but I'm learning all the time about the 21st century and technology. That's where I'm from. But is there something in what you've learned over that little, your career, that you've brought, you can bring into the 21st century and make it work?
At the end of the day, business is still all about people.
Okay, right.
People
right.
are your most important yep. asset. Mm-hmm. Forget artificial intelligence. We're way off of that, the replacing people. People are the most important business asset you have.
Yeah.
And one of the real problems you have is you get somebody at the age of 22 or 23 that's either come out of Oxbridge and gone straight on to London Business School, and they come out full of swank and full of passion, but they have very little, if any, emotional intelligence and no real right. experience of what happens in the real world. And we have the ability to be able to walk on eggshells. Because we're experienced, because we've got this emotional intelligence, because some of us are grandfathers,
right.
to actually go into a business and actually find out very quickly what the problems are
right.
and be able to say it in a very human way to the management in such a way that they don't particularly take a huff about
it. So it's not combative in
it's
that
not
sense.
Combative,
no,
it's
okay.
it's cooperative, and okay. that's the huge
yeah, yeah.
difference.
Right.
And also, because we're looking at it from so many different perspectives, we're far more likely to actually get to the real problems within
yes.
the business, which are often not the problems people see. Most people see as the problem when the figures don't work.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, your profit and loss account, a balance sheet, and I say that as a qualified accountant, is purely a scorecard. That's
yes.
all it is.
Yeah, yeah.
It's retro
as well.
And usually, unless it's management accounts, and even those are going to be yeah. several weeks retro.
Yes, exactly.
It is saying something, but it's not the beginning and the end.
No.
What you've really got to do, look at, is the substance of the business and the substance of the people, the substance of what makes the whole thing work, the dynamo within the business, the ideas within the business, the passion within the business,
okay.
and see whether or not it has become moribund and how you actually can somehow resurrect that.
So that is the human aspect.
It's
not something you put your finger on from an outsider.
You can't.
So you have to do it internally.
Yeah, the figures tell you one thing, but they don't tell
yeah.
you why.
Yeah, yeah, no.
They tell you.
You hear these reports about companies. I mean, the one that I always quote is that is something like Tesla, for example. You know, who appear to have burnt through about $2 billion so
far. They have.
Never had made
yeah.
any money.
Yeah.
And I'd quite like to burn through $2 billion, and see what sort I could make out of that. I haven't had the chance. I don't know whether Elon Musk had ever realised that he had the opportunity, and it's not his money, of course. But how a company like that can be influential? It's got a global reach now.
Mm.
They've taken on the big boys, more than whatever, in the motor industry. But they've still managed to lose colossal amounts of money.
Most of which is not theirs, most of which has been advance deposits by people who are buying their Teslas before they're even planned.
Well, I couldn't believe it. I'm talking about small business. The largest business I've been involved in is probably sort of the 5-6 million level, that sort of thing. But most of my enterprises have been startups and bring things to fruition, which is kind of what I can do. So you engage people and inspire people, that's the idea, to do things. Not necessarily going in the direction you might think. And that's what's exciting for me. But if you take someone like the Teslas, they had a marketing exercise. Did you see that with this truck? It was put out about 2 weeks ago, and Musk sat in front of it. It looked something like out of the Back to the Future. If you know the film.
Yes, I know the film.
The
yeah.
aluminium,
yeah, yeah.
sort of, the DeLorean.
The DeLorean, yeah.
yeah. And it looked ridiculous, but that was meant to. That was part of the deal. And they lobbed a steel ball at the windows, saying that they were bulletproof and unbreakable. And guess what happened?
They broke. Of course they did.
And he stood and presented for the next 20 minutes with a car with smashed windows, or a vehicle with smashed windows behind
yeah.
him.
Yeah.
Very obviously not worked. And he kind of made a joke, but he was genuinely irritated by this, because obviously they'd practiced beforehand and they hadn't done it. And they had to make excuses on this, at the time. But the next day they had 200,000 pre-ordered trucks. And they didn't even have a price. So it's call sort of, you know, gold dust or whatever it might be.
Well, people are trying to turn economics on its head, and maybe they're right. Who knows? You know, working on the basis of quality of life rather than anything else, rather than GDP. I mean, if you work on GDP, I mean, we've got all this nonsense with Brexit at the moment, but if you look at, for instance, at Yorkshire, the GDP of Yorkshire is actually probably bigger than five or six of the members of the common market, or, you know, as it stands by itself.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to get onto politics because I've got very strong views about that. The one thing I dislike intensely is people who tell lies.
Right.
Snobs and liars, I cannot tolerate.
No. Well, I think that's probably a lifelong lesson that we've learned.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's interesting. Just to throw that one in, I'm not going to get into the politics, but the idea that one is able to devolve areas, and you mentioned Yorkshire, into an economic package that we understand.
Yeah.
And I've got a small theory about this on the basis that I think maybe a lot of our issues about globalization is that we cannot comprehend the larger picture, but we can package something like the Yorkshire and be part of it and contribute and be happy and be human, which is interesting.
Yeah.
That's the key thing I think has come out of what we just said, is that people can comprehend that, but how Tesla and sit there around the real world and come up with it, I can't genuinely comprehend how that has come about. And I don't think, and my guess is, nor does Musk, but he's in a position he is, and he can throw anything at it, and he kind of does it. But I did hear a quote from him yesterday, and it was only yesterday, was that the guy said, you can go and buy anything you want, and so on. He says, well, actually, no, I don't have any cash. I don't have cash. It's all on. It's all shares.
It's all on tick.
So yeah, exactly. Yes. So he doesn't have any cash. Now that says to me, you know, literally, he couldn't. He lives in this bubble that is whatever that billionaire status.
Well, he's got a dream, hasn't he? And he's people are going along with the dream, and they're supporting the dream.
So
and if they stop supporting it, he's in real trouble.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that I find interesting, you know, we've gone through the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, we're still in the process of the information revolution. But really, what we need now is a clarity revolution. In other words, we've got far, far too much information coming from all kinds of directions. A lot of it's dross rather than being of any value. And somehow we're going to have people who are clear thinkers who can think through this.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, an awful lot of the politicians now sort of create dross. It's almost like this sort of, is it planes when they're trying to avoid being hit by an exocet, they throw out all this stuff. You know what I mean.
Yeah, the sparkly aluminium.
Yeah, to actually distract everybody.
Yes. Exactly.
And it's all about distraction techniques without actually looking at the clarity of everything.
It's just, isn't that just disguising ignorance?
Well, yeah, but it's all bullshit.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it is. I find, you know, when you're talking to people for the first time, or you're coming into a business and everything else, and I find it very difficult to sort of separate people's understanding of their business from the people themselves. And I've always been, you know, get the right people around you, and it always works, but get the wrong people around, and even you've got the best idea in the world, and it doesn't work. It really fails very quickly. But we seem to sort of kind of get stuck in this loop. And the interesting thing about that what we're doing with the podcasts and the blogging and all this sort of stuff is bringing these businesses together that wouldn't normally necessarily think they have anything in common. And the one thing that I would like to think, just as just a final kind of thing, because in the Hope Valley here, which you've adopted, you've been here 15 years.
I love it.
It's
I've been offered jobs back in London, but I don't take them.
Yeah, exactly. So this is coming back to the human elements of what we do and why we do it. Mm. You know, I mean, you've even moved your Sheffield office into Eam, which is probably the smallest village.
Yeah.
We're talking about the big picture, that we value our environments. We should value our environments. And, you know, I think you know I'm a big fan of the Peak District and using it and everything else. But going forward, it's not going to be the same as it was written by a strategic plan 70 years ago. So we're asking businesses to talk about how they're going to maintain their value within the environment they do business in, the Hope Valley. It's quite small. It's not Nova Yorkshire, it's Hope Valley. It's got a value. And it's just encouraging people to think like that. So we take the climate thing. It's the obvious one that people can kind of understand, in the sense that it's raining or you see changes. They don't have to understand the science, but they can understand beginning to make small improvements. And the companies we're asking here, which is quite interesting, that your companies, you know, when you come to your strategic due diligence and so on, I would like to think that climate ideal, where you are, the actual demographics is a serious part of it. I don't think we've done that to date.
No.
But when you can now talk about the scale of things within the Hope Valley, you have a perfect sort of cauldron of how you could make an impression or demonstrate best practice or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, and in a sense, we take our environment for granted. I mean, we have one of the most beautiful environments in the UK.
Yeah,
exactly. Possibly in Europe. And I mean, I'm due to become president of Hope Valley Rotary not next year, but the year after. And one of the things that we will try and do is to try to recognise the quality of the environment
where
we have,
you are.
And do whatever we can that's environmental. I was a district governor in Rotary about 12 years ago at the time of the floods in Sheffield, and we raised $1.5 million to actually help communities, not individuals, in and around South Yorkshire. We bailed out Tollgate, for argument's sake, which was a place near Doncaster. There were floods in Louth, Horncastle, all over the place. My area was about 5,000 square miles. I had 50 clubs to look after, which went on to Humberside, Lincolnshire, South Yorkshire.
Right.
And I suppose that itself made me recognise the quality of what I had out there, but less so in Sheffield. I mean, more so in Lincolnshire, funnily enough, because of course it's far more rural.
Well, you're making assumptions, I guess, on that basis.
Yeah.
But the people in the Rotary clubs. I mean, that's just one example. I mean, I'm not a member of Rotary, but I mean, I'm fully aware of, you know, the type of thing.
Yeah.
But I don't necessarily think it has to put it into clubs necessarily. You know, you've got people who are, who genuinely, you know, one-man bands, and they have an awful lot to offer. It doesn't have to be a large footprint, and that's kind of what is interesting about the Hope Valley.
Yeah.
You know, you've got hundreds, literally hundreds of...
Well, it's a community, isn't it?
It's a community, so you've got you've kind of got to build on that, make it bigger, or make people feel part of the community. I mean, there's plenty of people, I'm sure, who feel slightly disenfranchised in some ways, but the community is made up of many types of people, you know.
But there are also, unfortunately, there are the huge differentials. I mean, if you take Stony Middleton, the pupils at Stony Middleton School all have to have subsidised lunches because the parents can't necessarily afford to pay.
Right.
But equally, people looking at the Hope Valley would say we're a very high net worth community.
Right.
We are in some cases, but not in all cases.
No.
So there are huge differentials.
Well, one of the things that came out of the Fringe and the Hope Valley and the business was the college, the Hope Valley College, which was on the other end of the scale, and that the pupils were under the, you know, you felt that they were, you know, they had no hope and, you know, all that sort of stuff. In reality, it just needed to be teased out and realised that where they had. And then the local businesses supported with things like apprenticeships,
or
taking people on board, or sharing, you know, even just passing the business over, you know, the small businesses they are. Then there's the kids and the children, you know, they are aware that there are opportunities, rather than being told this is, you know, this is like kind of no hope type thing. That's a terrible pun in the Hope Valley. I always like the idea of Hope. It always sounds like a very positive place. So part of the climate action and the climate control blogging and the platform we've put together is being the idea that the Hope Valley was the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution. And in many
probably
ways,
you could, and things like
yes,
that, yes.
Yeah, you could actually argue that it was the source of all evil. And now we turn around and say, well, actually, why don't we become the source, the beginnings of how to change that? Yeah. And it makes it much more hopeful. Well, literally, that's what it is. So
And we have parts of the Hope Valley which people don't often get to, like Edale and places like that, simply because they're a bit more remote.
Yeah,
but they're a marvellous place.
I mean, I've travelled a lot, and you come back every time and you go, oh, this is quite nice. It's unique, definitely unique. And I've definitely, we were just as a final say, I was on Kinder on the weekend, and it's been horrendous weather until this weekend. And there's one weekend where my family, we had to get back. It's the only opportunity we could celebrate Christmas. So we had Christmas lunch last Sunday on the 1st of December, which is quite a bizarre.
Yeah.
But we went out on Kinder beforehand, and it was the most amazing day. It was almost summer-like.
Yeah.
It wasn't summer temperatures. It was absolutely spectacular. Yeah. And everybody, and there were people there who hadn't been there before.
Yeah.
And you think, very lucky. Anyway, excellent.
Okay.
There's a podcast done.
Yeah, you probably found that totally boring, but what the hell?
Well, that's for other people to judge.
Yeah.